This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of the show today, we're going to be exploring the question of what it means to be Asian American, specifically whether it makes sense to have a single marker of identity for that broad group of people hailing from a huge portion of Earth's landmass, and how they fit into a nation that has a long-standing binary along the poles of black and white. My guest is J. Caspian Kang. He's a writer for the New York Times, co-host of the podcast Time to Say Goodbye, and the author most recently of The Loneliest Americans, a memoir and exploration of what it means to be Asian in America. He writes, "At best, our white suburban neighbors regard us with conditional tolerance. Our fellow minorities look upon our race work with a mixture of bemusement and suspicion. It's hard to blame anyone for not caring enough about Asian Americans because nobody, most of all Asian Americans, really believes that Asian America actually exists." He goes on to say, "While most Americans might not be able to tell the difference between me, a 41-year-old first-generation Korean immigrant raised in an educated middle-class household, and the first-generation undocumented immigrant from Fujian province who delivers their meals, that doesn't mean some bond has been forged out of this misunderstanding." J. Caspian Kang, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I want to begin with the Hart-Celler Act, which is a piece of legislation that is sort of central to your book's arguments. Lyndon Johnson signed it October 3rd, 1965, standing next to the Statue of Liberty. It aimed to eliminate the old quota system that limited new immigrants based on what their respective populations had been in 1920, but largely excluding people from Africa and Asia. Johnson explained the change this way.
"This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power. Yet it is still one of the most important acts of this Congress and of this administration. For it does repair a very deep and painful flaw in the fabric of American justice."
Okay, Jay, so not going to affect the lives of millions. That's a solid falsifiable prediction there. How'd that work out?
Well, every time I hear that clip, I just start laughing because I try and imagine, you know, any politician passing a bill and then just sort of saying, "Listen, this isn't going to do anything, you know, like, don't worry about it. You know, like, we're just doing this because, you know, it's sort of, some people think it's the right thing to do," which is really the attitude that RFK had at the time. It's the attitude that Lyndon Johnson had at the time. It's the attitude that a lot of Democrats had at the time, who were the ones who were trying to pass this bill. And their basic idea was that by lifting these quotas and by opening up immigration, that the country's immigration laws would fall more in line with the civil rights, civil rights sort of legislation that they had passed in the prior years. And there's also a lot of concerns about how a racist immigration policy was being perceived abroad, and a lot of foreign policy goals that the United States had, and how that was sort of being talked about in Asia, right? Where countries in Asia would say, like, you know, like, why would you work with the United States? Why would you not hate the United States, given that they won't even let you in this country, right? And so this was supposed to be really just sort of like a gestural thing. Like, it was supposed to be fully symbolic. And yet, you know, they're wrong. You know, like, millions and millions of people came into the United States, and you know, that's why we have the multiracial country that we have today. It's because of this one act, 1965 Hart-Celler Act.
And it's strange because not too many people talk about it very much outside of your book and some academics, and I guess Tucker Carlson and people who,
right,
are, you know, but it's not something that I think is well known.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the people who talk about the most are right-wing pundits, right? Right-wing think tanks. They've sort of, and they use it to spread alarm that, like, 1965 changed America, and now we have a different country of outsiders or whatever. And in that way, they are actually factually correct, right? Like, it did change America, and it's why we have the country that we have today. I've never really understood the resistance talking about it from progressives or Democrats. You know, perhaps there's some reticence to just say, hey, we have a we have a vastly different country than we had in 1964. But yeah, it's generally not talked about too much on the left.
So you mentioned RFK, Robert F. Kennedy. I think I read in your book that he predicted, what, 5,000 people in the first few years tapering off after that?
Yeah.
In fact, it was millions. Most, yeah.
Yeah, the most it'll get to is about 5,000. It's almost like he was predict. You know, it's like one of the people who were like wrong about COVID, you know?
Right.
At the very beginning, where they're like, it'll be like a few thousand people will get it and then it'll die off because of the weather or something like that. Like, that's how he was talking about it in terms of immigrant. And, you know, this is a bill that he championed. This is a bill that he wanted to pass. And, you know, obviously the reasons for that are quite clear that, you know, they were that even as passing, even through passing this bill, they were worried that, you know, it would be perceived as this, you know, changing of America, this fundamental changing of the country, and that there might, it might inspire a type of nativist backlash, which, you know, it has throughout the last 30 years, right? Not just Trump, but in the 1990s as well, right? There have been nativist backlashes to you know, the new America.
Something I did not appreciate until encountering your book is that, what, more than 95% of people from Asia in America today who can trace their lineage to Asia came after 1965?
Right. The way that I put it is usually that almost every Asian person that you come across, you know, whether friends or family members or people working in restaurants, people working at your corporation, almost all these people that you meet, their parents will have come post 1965. The population of Asian people in 1960 in America, I believe, was something around like 600 to 800,000 people. Right. And now there's 25 million Asian Americans, or around 20 million Asian Americans in this country. And yeah, it's obviously, you know, it's hard to get from 600,000 to 20 million just through, you know, having kids and stuff. So yeah, it's almost every Asian person that you know, I would imagine their parents came post 1965.
So of these millions of immigrants, you write, although their new country did have pockets of people who look like them, they shared almost nothing in common with their fellow quote-unquote Asian Americans, except some well-worn threads of culture, whether food or holiday rituals, and the assumptions of white people. So I think some people who feel differently about Asian American identity than you do, and we can get into that, those assumptions right. of white people are enough. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that in many ways they are, right? Like, I think that racism, if you are thinking about race in terms of how it affects your daily life and how the rest of society looks at you, then I do think that perhaps there's not so much difference, right? So like, if I was walking down the street with somebody whose family had immigrated here, let's say during like the gold rush, and they're, you know, Chinese American, I'm Korean American, and somebody came up wanting to punch a Asian person in the face, like, you know, there's like a 50-50 shot there, right? Like, so that is a reality. But that is also not like people's lived lives. It's also not the way that people politically organize themselves. It's not the way that they think about themselves either. And it's not just sort of a personal identification question. Like, the, as I said, like the way that people actually form coalitions, the way that people participate in politics is driven not by this idea of Asian Americanness. It's driven by the experiences that they had in their home country. It is, you know, it's affected by where they decide to immigrate in this country, right? Like moving to Orange County, California, for example, or let's say like Lewiston, Maine is very different than moving to Flushing, Queens, and you're going to have a different type of experience there. And it comes from the communities that you encounter of your own people when you get to the United States, which is very, very different across different countries, right? Vietnamese people in Texas, for example, have a very different community, I would say, than if you just drive down the street and you go to an Indian American community, you know, in the suburbs of Dallas, right? Like these are the politics are different. The voting patterns are widely different. Like Indian Americans are about like 90% Democrat. Vietnamese are somewhere in the 40s Democrat, right? So to lump all these different things together just based on the idea that you know, white people will see you as the same, right? And I would even say that white people wouldn't see Indian people and Vietnamese people as the same either. You know, there's an incoherence there that I try and get to in the book.
And I want to come back to those sort of political questions, because I'm a former political reporter myself, and right. I do tend to see things through that lens. But let me just take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the writer J. Caspian Kang, whose book is The Loneliest Americans. It's about Asian American identity. And if you want to join our conversation, if you have a question or comment for our guest, 800-222-9455 is the number to call, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21ST Show. So a few years ago, you gave a speech. Let me back up on that. I want to talk a little more about this idea of Asian American identity. Where did that come from? You write about this in the book, Berkeley in the 1960s. Can you talk about who sort of birthed that idea, and maybe why it's disconnected from the lived experiences of the majority of people who today are in the category of Asian American?
Right. In the late 60s in Northern California mostly, but throughout California on college campuses, there's a lot of sort of, consciousness movements that went on that were associated in a lot of ways with anti-war movements. And so you have the Black Panthers, for example, you have the Chicano movement, right? Like these are very well known. You also have at Cal Berkeley, the formation of something called the Asian American Political Alliance. This is where the term Asian American is coined, right? It's famously in some house that actually, I live in Berkeley. It's not too far from where I am. So I think about it quite a bit when I drive by the house. These are students, mostly Japanese and Chinese, right? And some Filipino, although Filipino students generally thought of themselves as separate from the Japanese and Chinese, who wanted to try and create a political identity around this. Like before they were sort of known as Orientals or Chinese or Japanese. And they wanted to sort of organize all the people who are not organized by the other groups, right? That was their sort of motto. Like, we'll take everybody who's not in the Chicano movement or the Black movement or anti-war movement, whatever. And these students, though, had been in the United States mostly for 5-6 generations, 3 generations, maybe. The person who coined the term had been interned, right? He had sort of grown up in a Japanese internment camp. And so their understanding of America through generations of living in this country, where they're such a small minority of the country, where they had seen a lot of evidence of racism, of white supremacy, like it was very fixed in their mind. And it makes sense that they would try and create a political alliance from it. You know, a few years before, though, like they had sort of formed this identity. That's the beginning. That's 1965. And as they're sort of trying to form an Asian American identity, tons and tons of Asian people start to enter the United States, right? Who have very little understanding of America, right? Like they were not interned, right? Like they don't understand the history of the gold rush. They don't know about the lynchings in Chinatown and Los Angeles in the 19th century, right? The history is very abstract to them. Like they don't feel a connection with the Asian Americans who were already here. And yet what's happened, both in the academy, but also in the media, and also I think just in the terms of formation of political coalitions, is that everyone assumes that we all have that same history, right? Like that we have that old history, that we all know about that history, and that we all agree that that history is informative in our lives. And I don't think that that's true at all. I think about my own family. It's like, do my parents consider themselves Asian American? Absolutely not, right? They consider themselves Korean. They sometimes consider themselves American, right? I think that, increasingly they consider themselves American. But the idea of Asian America linked to some sort of radical student movement and consciousness movement based in, the history of American white supremacy is just not a reality for them. And, I think the book in some ways is trying to be a gentle wake-up call to people just saying, like, we have to think about these things in more accurate ways. Like we have to understand that the terms that people like myself are very familiar with, the histories that people like myself are familiar with, are not really applicable to the vast majority of people who are called Asian Americans.
And you talk about in your own family, people who, were raised in Korea with a sort of an instilled with a hatred of Japanese people because right. of the occupation. Yeah, I mean, they're not going to feel like there's that natural kinship necessarily.
Right, right. Or at the very least, they'll be confused about it for a very long period of time. And I would just say anecdotally, the a lot of the Korean people that I know, like, you know, like the idea of being in any sort of coalition with Japanese people is like, you know, I don't know, sort of anathema to how they were raised and the prejudices or the, you know, or the thoughts that they had coming to the United States.
Yeah. We need to take a break in a couple of minutes. So maybe this will be the last question, about a minute and a half left. But you talk, rather than this idea of the people who came here, rather than having that experience with American racism or oppression, they had, you have this phrase, born into the collateral damage of American imperialism. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it, your experiences with America when you first come over here are colored not by an understanding of American history, but, you know, a history of what America did in your country, right? So for my parents, you know, born into the Korean War, right, growing up with military bases and American occupation, like that's a very specific history of America. For people from Vietnam, obviously, right, like refugees from Vietnam, they have a very specific understanding of what America did and what America means. And that colors their understanding of America much more than, you know, like sort of narratives about American racism and you know, like histories of the Civil War or whatever. These are very relevant to Americans, but I don't know that they're particularly relevant to new immigrants who come to the United States. Now, this isn't just Asians, right? It's immigrants from any country would sort of go through this process of trying to understand America with their background being, you know, what America did in their countries.
All right, we're going to take a break. We're speaking with the writer J. Caspian Kang. His book is The Loneliest Americans. He's also got an excellent newsletter from the New York Times, which is about some of these topics, but also electric bicycles and video games and other great things, too. I would recommend that as well. We're going to continue this conversation. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. 9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show, at 21st Show. More to come with J. Caspian Kang after a break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the writer J. Caspian Kang. He writes for the New York Times. He's co-host of the podcast Time to Say Goodbye. And his book is The Loneliest Americans, which is about, as we've been discussing, Asian American identity and the limits of that identity, in his view. Let's talk about, in a post you wrote for the website Free Darko, this is some years ago, you talk about earliest days. All hail intern Zany for digging this up. But you talk about your earliest days in New York City. You see Asian kids casually dropping the N-word on a basketball court in a familiar, friendly way. No one, including the black people nearby, seem to think much of it. You are sort of shocked, as you describe it. I won't quote the exact phrase, although it's delightful. And then you overhear two kids speaking Korean, and you turn around and are surprised to see they're black. And you wondered how you'd gotten to age 23 without meeting an Asian American kid who had grown up much differently than you. So how did that happen?
Well, you know, I grew up in North Carolina, I think is the answer.
I guess more broadly speaking, right? I mean, yeah. Like you weren't. What was your conception of your identity growing up, I guess?
Right. Well, you know, I grew up in North Carolina in a time, there are many Asian people in the town that I grew up in, which is Chapel Hill, North Carolina now, right? But I suppose that at the time when my sister and I were growing up there in the 90s, there weren't many at all. Like our high school was very large. I think it's about 4,000 kids. And I think that there are like probably 10 Asian kids there. And so, you know, like I think that for my generation, right, there's a lot of kids like me, like my sister, sort of pushed out the door in these places where they are certainly alone, right? And their parents don't really have a very good sense of how to deal with this fact, right? Like you're one of the only ones here. There's no real template for them. So they're shoved out the door. This is something that I did a podcast with Andrew Yang at some point, and, you know, this is something I talked about with him, where it's just like, it seems like we had very similar upbringings in a way, right? And as a way, you sort of start to you start to sort of internalize a lot of stuff. You don't know the language to discuss it. You don't know really how to talk about it at all because nobody at your home talks about it. But you're sort of expected to blend in, right? Which of course is an impossible thing to do, but you try your best. And then in the end, you end up at the age of 23 and you go walk around Flushing in New York because you've just moved there to go to graduate school. You know, you went to college in Maine in my case, and then you're there and you're like, oh my God, you know, how did I get here? You know, like how much is this denial of self? How much is this process of assimilation? Like how powerful was it where that, like, I'm sure that I saw some of these people. I just didn't think about it very much, right? Because you're just trying to get through the day. And what type of like neurosis, what type of trauma does that build? Now, you know, like I'm somewhat skeptical, or not skeptical, but I do not like to use the word trauma lightly, but, you know, certainly neurosis, right? Like you start to really think about, like, well, you know, if I got to here, then like, what did I miss? Right. And, you know, I think a part of the book, the parts that are personal about what this process was like, right. And I try and be very honest about it. Right. I think that there's a, try and resist the tendency to say, to be knowing about this stuff, because I still don't know what the effects are. And I don't even know if it was good or bad. You know, like, I don't, it's hard to like even put up, because, you know, my parents did have to move to North Carolina, you know, their children were placed in a very strange predicament. And I don't know, maybe like sort of just being like, put your head down and figure it out. Maybe that's a good pathway, you know, but it certainly did not allow me, I think, or my sister's a little bit better, but like, you know, me or my sister in a lot of ways to like try and figure out these questions of identity when we might have needed to at the ages of like 15, 16, 17, 18. Like it always came later.
You know, I was reading your book, I was reminded of this training video we had at work last summer, I think it was summer 2020, right? That's one of those things about, it was about microaggressions. And as I remember it, and I may have some of the details wrong because it was a year ago, but it was an Asian woman running, jogging, and some, you know, white guy comes up and they strike up a conversation and he says like, so where are you from? And she's like, oh, Springfield. No. Where are your people from? And she's like, oh, Chicago. You know, and you see what I'm getting at.
Right.
I wonder what is your experience of that? And I mean, it kind of like, in some ways, it epitomizes this assimilation you're talking about, right? Because she doesn't think of herself as anywhere but from Springfield or Chicago or whatever it was.
Right. I mean, my general sense of this is that we should be a little bit more. There is a tendency, I think, amongst progressive and generally upwardly Asian, mobile Asian Americans to take these types of moments and turn them into, you know, moments of deep and ingrained racism. And, you know, I think that there needs to be a little bit of a reckoning with that impulse, right? Because I always think about it in terms of the example that's always given in New York City, and I'm sure it's given in Chicago too, where somebody, an Asian person, generally an Asian man who might work at a bank or might work in journalism or whatever, is in their building and delivery person comes up, and the delivery person is poor, right? The delivery person is Chinese, bringing Chinese delivery. And that somebody in the building mistakes this sort of professional Asian American for the delivery boy. Right? And this is supposed to be this moment of great outrage. And I've always thought about it because, you know, it's happened to me. It happened to me when I lived in New York quite a bit. And, you know, it's not a pleasant thing to go through. In some ways, you feel embarrassed for yourself. You also feel kind of embarrassed for the other person, right? But, you know, like why are the people mad? You know, like why do people get so mad about this? Is it because they're being mistaken for being another Asian person, or are they mad because they're mistaken for being poor? Right. I would say it's the opposite, you know, or the second ladder of those, right? Like that the real offense is being mistaken for being like one of the unwashed Asian Americans. And I think that too much of our microaggression discourse around Asian America actually is built along those class lines, right? Like it's like and you saw it like during the COVID pandemic at the early parts, right? Where they're like, hey, I'm one of your doctors, you know, I'm a nurse, you know, like actually I, you know, I'm the VP of like an investment bank, you know, like we're your
CEO
rich neighbors,
Google, right?
Yeah. right. I run Google. That's, you know, that it's rooted in a type of both class, but also type of, you know, like immigrant, like, prejudice that makes me really uncomfortable. You know, like it really does. Like I always think it's like, well, I'm not one of the bad ones, right? I'm not one of the coronavirus Asians. And I don't know. I think that a lot of that is rooted in that. Like the people who, and for your example that you give, right? Like what is it saying? You know, like, well, actually I'm one of the people who speak perfect English and I've been in the United States for, you know, I came here in 1979 and my parents also speak English. Like, what does that say about people who just got here, right? Like, why are you trying to distance yourself from those people? And then if somebody makes a mistake, right? Like maybe it is offensive in some sort of way, but is your offense that the person made the mistake or is the offense that the person mistook you for somebody who just got here? Like somebody who's fresh out the boat, somebody who's poor, works in a restaurant, stuff like that. And so, I don't know. I generally either roll my eyes or, you know, quietly just sort of don't think about those types of moments very much because, you know, I think that the offense is always rooted in a type of, you know, lack of real class consciousness that I think is much more important than making sure that every white person, you know, addresses you in the exact way that you want.
Yeah. Well, so, and this gets maybe this idea of class consciousness as opposed to some sort of pan racial identity is one of the things that I think your book is about in a lot of ways. You've also written about this in the New York Times. There was a piece recently, Democrats still don't understand Asian American voters. And you note that they shifted right in the 2020 election, right, despite anti-immigrant rhetoric from former President Donald Trump. Why does that happen? And how does that fit into your, you know, your questions about Asian American identity and assumptions that people make about it, especially in the political world?
I think that for about 20 years, the Democratic Party's assumption was that if they could talk about anti-racism broadly, that they would bring in all of the people who are all of the races together, right? Like that you could do one message and just say, hey, the Republicans are racist and, you know, we're not. And so you should vote for us, right? Like this is sort of the general anti-racist speak that was given. It's not particularly relevant to the people who live in Latino and Asian communities, right? Like some of them might be, you know, some of them might be anti-Black themselves, right? Like that's a thing. Like, and then a lot of them might have very specific political issues that they vote on, right? So for example, in New York City, you see a swing because, you know, they want to, there's all this movement in the last mayoral administration to get rid of Stuyvesant, Bronx Science. These are testing elite magnet schools, right? That are heavily, heavily Asian, like 70 to 80% Asian. The idea that they would bring equity to these schools, that they would make them less Asian and let in more Black students. The number of Black students that are let in every year to these schools is pretty shamefully low, like something like 8 students or something like that. That's not necessarily in the, you know, in the supposed or the, I guess, perceived best interest of a lot of Asian families who think that these schools are their pathway into the middle class or their kids' pathway into Yale or Harvard or, you know, one of these schools like Dartmouth or something like that, right? And so, you know, there is a lack of specificity, right? There's a lack of understanding of these communities and what they actually want. And I think that that has led to a certain type of leeching off of support to the right. Now, you know, this also has to do with the Asian attacks, right? Curtis Sliwa, who is a Republican person running for mayor in New York City, really sort of went hard on this in Asian communities, and the swings in those communities were huge, right? He was saying, we need more police in these communities. We need, the Democrats want to defund the police. I want more police to help protect you. Right? Like these are going to be powerful messages in those communities. And the reason why the Democrats are starting to fail in those communities, I think in large part is because like, they just don't understand what those communities actually think, right? Like, and you know, it's getting, I will say though, that in the last 6 years, it's gotten better, right? You see actual outreach in Texas and California, very specific outreach, but it's mostly in sort of congressional districts. Nationally, the Democrat Party, I think, still has this problem.
All right, we only have a few minutes left and so much more I wanted to talk about, but that's how these things always go. I guess I want to end by asking you, I know you were influenced by Noel Ignatieff, who's, of course, probably best known for his book, How the Irish Became White. He wanted to abolish whiteness. And I wonder if your understanding is that a lot of Asians maybe want, rather than that to sort of have a seat at the white table rather than to have their own Asian American table? I wonder if you can just talk about that to sort of end our conversation.
Yeah. Noel sort of pioneered whiteness studies, but you know, his conception of it was much different than what you see today in authors like Robin DiAngelo, for example, right? Like, this is not an argument about white fragility or a personal thing. It's an argument about economic and racial systems and how they operate. You know, in Noel's case, like he was talking about within the labor market. And that the problem that he identified was that Asian Americans should, or I'm sorry, that white people, you know, instead of sort of seeing that the enemy was the management, right, in the factories, they would take little advantage that they got over black workers and then side with management because of them, right? Like, so that's where the term like white skin privileges came from, which is something that he coined that now has, you know, been sort of, I don't know, mushed down into this idea of white privilege, which, you know, is very different than what he was talking about. And that his idea was that white people need to forget that they're white, right? Like that's what he always said. And they need to look up and see who's actually oppressing them and who's actually also oppressing black people. And that like, this is the revolutionary moment that is the only way to get like true equality in America. And that's a very specific like revolutionary and, you know, radical Marxist view. Now for me, you know, like being one of his students and being somebody who was very influenced by him, like my sense of Asian America is that, you know, like the people who are Asian American in the way that I am, right? Like sort of upwardly mobile people who have professional jobs, might write for places like the New York Times or might work in Hollywood, might be doctors, right? Like these people need to sort of forget about Asian American identity as it's been taught to us. And we need to start to think about who the Asian people are who actually need the most help, right? Like who are the people who are struggling the most? And, you know, like it goes to the divide that I talked to in the example of the delivery worker and the person who's mistaken for the delivery worker, right? Mm. Like that type of mentality, right? Like, how dare you think I'm poor? How dare you think I'm an immigrant? I'm just as rich an American as you. Like that needs to be what's abolished, right? That needs to be what's forgotten. And, you know, the book, I hope, is a call to that. You know, obviously it's been somewhat controversial because of that, but I don't know. I think that this is the only way for the term Asian American or the people of Asian America politically and both, you know, and also like in sort of this soul type of way,
sure,
to have any type of meaning. Because right now I do think it's like quite a meaningless term.
J. Caspian Kang is the author of The Loneliest Americans. I really enjoyed reading it. Thank you for coming on to talk with us today about it on the conference.
Hey, thank you so much. This is great.
And that is it for today's program. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll be back tomorrow with an interview with Governor Pritzker. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you then. We'll